My name is Vince Horan, and I'll be the facilitator this weekend. I'm from Tacoma. I'm presently in my second marriage with three children. We have two from my wife's first marriage, my present wife's first marriage, and then we have one child together. So I've had some years in history of experience in working both in single parenting and being a step-parent, having a blended family. I was married 6 years the first time around, waited 4 years, and have been married 10 years the second time around. And a part of the benefit and the value of me being here with you to do this single parents retreat is the recognition that there was a time in both in my first marriage and out of my first marriage where I felt lost, confused, ashamed, guilty, afraid, angry, scared, because a lot of what evolved in my taking on responsibilities of husband, lover, friend, and father eventually, all were done as a part of a dream of this culture, a dream about what it means to mature and grow up. But for me, what a lot of that dream led to was a lot of horror and terror and scare and sorrow and pain, because I never realized and never really knew how to do those things that were lifelong dreams and goals and ambitions. So while I lived in the illusion and the romantic history and mystery of love and family and marriage, the reality was a shock to my system. And failure in that reality was even a bigger shock to my system. The inability to know how to nurture, to affirm, to educate, to know who and what I could be as a person. And then what came along with all of that was all of the judgments. All of the judgments of a church and a culture that itself was very ignorant and insensitive to my needs. All the judgments of my own upbringing, the fears of inadequacy and failure, the fear that somehow I had let myself down, my wife down, and children down. And it was a group of people like this kind of meeting, a group of people who gathered together to say, wait a minute, you know, there's something in all of this pain and something in all of this experience that we all have to teach each other. But the biggest part of our learning to teach each other was that we needed to start with unconditional love. We needed to come together in a way and say, we all have something of value and something important, whether we're divorced, widowed, never been married, married, that we all as human beings are a part of the same kind of journey, and that our history is a teaching and a learning for us. And one of the great messages that our history and teaching and learning does for us is that it offers us a chance to look back and see what's missing. And the tragedy of our culture is that oftentimes what we do when we experience loss, change, pain, is that we try to numb it or ignore it, or we try to compulsively rush out and find another way to make it happen somewhere else. And so what we do is recycle habits and patterns over and over and over again. And what happened for me when I was going through this process was understanding that when there was a different way, when somebody was able to touch me on a different level, to give me a chance to step out of the preoccupation with old views and old visions and old dreams and step back and look at myself and my experience and my history in a different way. Then I found hope. I found hope because I wasn't alone. I found hope because there was, you know, I mean, this whole mystery of what's going on. I love the way that things happen up here because, you know, there's something afoot in the universe, and I believe that that's, you know, a spiritual path, that we are in a major stage of transition, culturally, cosmically, universally. And I've been listening to several people. Somebody's been running around saying, what's the song that's going around, Don't Worry? Is that Dave? Yeah, well, see, it works out cosmically. So I think God has a wonderful spirit, because that was one of the things that I wanted to start with tonight. And the title of this part of the talk, and the way that we're going to move in this direction, is tonight what I'd like to do is to share an overview, to give you a perspective from my point of view, so that you might get to know me a little bit and kind of where I'm coming from, so that all the rest of the weekend will then be an outgrowth that will really come from this overall view and perspective, but then talk to you about your experience. Because what's important for me is for you to understand that wherever we are in our process, in our journey, in our path, in our growth, that we all have something in common to teach and to learn and to support and affirm with one another. And being gathered in this kind of setting, with this kind of process, I think is a part of allowing the living spirit of life to minister through us, to us and through us to one another. So tonight is a kind of a retrospective look at history and culture and what it speaks to us in terms of church, in terms of marriage and values and parenting, because we literally come out of a culture of denial. We come out of a culture of ignorance. And so what you and I are doing is trying to live and manifest that ignorance so that there is the hope for change. But in that process of change, we have to minister to each other, because it's frightening and it's terrifying and it's painful. But there's hope in the pain. And the words that I wanted to start with were this reading from Matthew. It says, do not worry. Do not say, what are we to eat? Or what are we to drink? Or how are we to be clothed? Your heavenly Father knows you need them all. Set your heart on his or her kingdom first, and all these other things will be given you as well. And that quote is real important, because especially in Western civilization today, we are a culture of worry. We are a culture of busyness. We are a culture of obsessions. Obsessions with things, obsessions with labels, obsessions with goals, obsessions with power. And so we become occupied. And when we become occupied, our life becomes busy and full. But one of the consequences of being busy is that we get so busy that we lose our center. We lose our spirituality. What we do is we get so invested in dreams and goals and ideas about what we think life is supposed to be for us. See, what for you were the messages you were told, you remember floating around in your dreamy little child head about what it meant to be a grown-up? Share some of your messages you meant, what you heard about. What were you told about being happy or growing up?
Have to do things you don't want to do.
You have to do things you don't want to do.
Nobody said it would be easy.
Nobody said it'd be easy.
We can play when the work's all done.
Play when the work's all done. What were some of the other dreams and goals? What did you want to be when you grew up?
A mommy.
A mommy, okay.
I wanted to be the man from Uncle.
The man from Uncle. The old TV show, I remember that one.
You work hard, you'll get what you want.
Do you treat people fair, they'll treat you.
For me, I was raised in a good, poor to middle class, it was actually a lower middle class Irish, Italian, Catholic home. So for me, what it meant was I had to grow up, get an education, get a good job, find a gal to marry, settle down, and raise a family. And that was the goal of life. Does that ring a bell for anybody? How are you to achieve these goals? How did you find out what love meant? How would you know when you were in love?
You just know.
That's what I know. You just know, okay? What were the rest of you told about when you were in love?
Butterflies in your stomach.
Butterflies? About bells going off? When you meet Mr. Right or Miss Right? What other kind of things were you told about being in love?
We never talked about it. You know, that's my experience too. Mm-hmm. Silence.
Silence.
And what you got it from the media. Mm-hmm.
See, and that's a part of the cultural conflict and problem in our culture, is that we set up the ideal and the vision of love and marriage as a goal or a dream, but there is nobody to teach us. The assumption is that the church will teach us. I know my preparation for my first marriage was 3 one-hour counseling sessions with a man who's never been married before. And that was my preparation for a lifetime of marriage. How did you learn about sex? How many of you learned it from your parents? Jackie. We're all going to Jackie's house after this.
It was the book they gave.
How many of you learned about it in school? I love you. How many of you had to find out by yourself? How many of you feel adequate that the education you got about sexuality—that's what. After we go to Jackie's parents' house, we'll all go. Okay. See, and a part of what I want you to hear with this is that the concepts of marriage and family and mothering and fathering are wonderful dreams, and they are truly a gift, a ministry. They are a wellspring of life. They are essential to the survival of the human race. But the reality is that we live in a culture of ignorance and denial. So what happens is we become the blind leading the blind. The assumption in our culture is that it is for family and church to teach us the benefits of marriage. Well, let's take a minute and look at church. And church, when they, you know, especially the Catholic tradition, you know, as it evolved down the years, in the Catholic tradition, as the these men, priests, who were separating themselves from the common folk, we're trying to decide what was sacramental and religious, the Catholic Church put marriage in as one of the 7 major sacraments as an afterthought. Do you know the reason why they put marriage in as a sacrament? Anybody answer that? because they were afraid of rebellion from the masses, because most of the sacramental rituals were centered on and focused on, you know, the priesthood. And that there was a concern, a rumbling, that the masses or the individuals or the groups of people, that there was nothing there for them. And so marriage was added as a sacrament, so that somehow the masses could feel sacramental in terms of the church ritual. Not a real lovely concept, you know, when you talk about the focus. But what happens is that while the church, and I'm talking organized religion here, while the church as an organized religion sacramentalized marriage, what they didn't know how to do was to teach the masses. So literally what they did is simply go to the proclamations in the gospel and to go back into history. And in history, Moses, you know, I mean, again, the essential sacramental rite is that marriage between man and woman is a covenant as Yahweh to his people. And so fidelity was to be the primary value of marriage. You know, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. Moses, during the period in the desert, said, we can have divorce laws. And the Pharisees asked Jesus, well, what about divorce? And there are two different accounts in the Gospels. Mark's account is basically pretty clear, basically saying, if a man divorces his wife, and marries another, he is committing adultery in the same, in reverse. You know, that what no man has put together, I mean, what God has joined together, no man put asunder. Matthew does the same, except for Matthew kind of leaves an exclusion clause, except for in the cases of an adulterous relationship. And it's been based on those two scriptural texts that the church has evolved its concept of marriage. Now, I want you to hear that this is a male-dominated, predominantly unmarried group of people who are determining the values and the rituals and laws. Now, what's frightening about that experience is that, one, it's highly sexist, because the view and the attitude of the church at that particular time toward women is that women were inferior creatures. Women were inferior because they had menstrual periods. The reigning philosophy of the church at that time was that to be filled with spirit and grace was to avoid all earthly things. And since women had menstrual cycles, they were too tied to the earth, therefore they could never be close to God. They could never ascend to the level of power and spirituality. What are you all feeling inside as you're hearing me say these words?
Anger.
Good. You need to feel anger and rage, because you need to understand that underneath all of the dreams and hopes that we have about that, there is this kind of misguided value system that still lives in the core of our culture and still impacts and affects who we are as people and how we define our roles in terms of man and woman, husband and wife. And we are still guided by values. And remember that a lot of what happens with the values is that one of the things that, you know, especially in my tradition, the Catholic tradition, the Eastern Orthodox people talk about the Catholic tradition as the, you know, as the developers of what they call original guilt. Because what we have done in this tradition by the creating of these standards and trying to make them so dogmatic is that literally what has happened is that nobody could possibly live up to these standards, but what is left is simply the proclamation And it was another way of the priesthood separating itself. Well, we'll set up these boundaries and rules for you. If you fail them, you're sinners. And that's what we're here for, just to forgive your sin, but you're basically sinners. We are called to be the special one. Those of you out there, if you can't manage by our standards and rules, there's something wrong with you. So you're left to feel the inadequacy. And what I want you to hear is that it isn't you. It was all those rules. The intrinsic value of marriage as a contract or as a covenant is valid. But it isn't what Christ taught. A part of what Christ was talking about when you understand Scripture in the context of Christ in his day was his anger and rage at the way that women were treated, at the hypocrisy of the ways that he is being trying to trap by these legalists, the way that the culture has literally lived, especially in the church. What they had lived was is that they set up all these values for the common folk, but they could do all of their things on the side. It was okay for them. You know, so while the the church was preaching this kind of ascetic discipline, ritualized, rigid, structured value system in life, you know, what was happening is that, well, people were saying, well, yes, when I'm in this role and I do this thing, this is fine, but when I'm over here on Friday night partying, I can do what I want to do because I'm not in the role of the church. And they were able to separate themselves, but the common folk weren't. Because the common folk, we were kept out, and we were not allowed at that point to challenge. Now let's look at this concept of marriage today. The whole concept. Oops. Let's try another color. Well, we're talking about romance, so we'll use red. The concept of romantic love is basically only 100 years old. And that's a really important fact for us to look at today. See, because when you look at the rigidity of the values and the laws of the church, it's real important to understand that up to 100 years ago, marriages were arranged. Marriages were arranged for convenience sake. They were arranged for the propagation of the faith. You didn't have to love your wife. What you did was basically trade, you know, cattle, whatever was available. You made arrangements in trade, and so you had your wife, there was an exchange of responsibility. Most of it was that the woman's role was to be a role of subservience to the husband. The husband literally bought or bartered with the woman's parents for the exchange of this person. And if the man wanted love or romance or sex and he wasn't satisfied with his wife, it was okay for the man to go off somewhere else and get it. And that's been a value system that has lived for thousands of years. That's what Jesus was making those statements about. Challenging the belief system of the day. Now for you and I today, the concept of adding love to a relationship, to a marriage contract, while it can be exciting and wonderful, changes the whole focus. Because the other thing that it does is it brings in the whole concept of choice. Now, my marriage is not arranged generally by my parents or by some marriage broker. Instead, in our culture today, it is now you get to go out and find who it is you want to fall in love with. And then you make your dream happen. Well, all of those laws that were legislated before as basic guidelines of this is how you maintain your contract, is that you maintain these basic basic values of fidelity, fidelity to the spouse, you work hard, keep your nose to the grindstone, don't talk about sex, raise children, keep the community flourishing. Those were all very pragmatic and practical reasons. But now we have this whole phenomenon of emotions and romantic love and eroticism and how to make choices about partners. And who is there to teach us about what that means and how to do that? See, a lot of those things that you were talking about before, that's the basis of what we have learned about how to fall in love. What I want you to hear, and the important concept today, is to understand that romance is illusion. Romance is living in a fantasy. It's about creating an image and an excitement and projecting my illusion of romance, of what I want my partner to be, and it's about two people being in a dance with each other. Being in a dance of somehow trying to make their illusion reality. Unfortunately, a lot of what happens is when we're living in this illusion, and we get into and try to do it, when we live together, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, the romance wears off. Because when you're in a relationship together, what tends to happen is that there's too much reality and you can't live in your fantasy anymore. So you may think that this is a wonderful, beautiful creature that you've discovered and fallen in love with. And maybe that person was a wonderful, beautiful creature because they worked very hard to impress you to be a wonderful, beautiful creature. But what they find is when you get together and you live together, you can't keep up that kind of energy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So what happens is after a while they stop being as wonderful and beautiful as they were when we were romantic. You remember that? Really, when you met somebody, you wanted to impress them, so you really went out of your way to try to be nice. I know for myself, it used to be, I was Mr. Nice Guy, I go out of my way, I go and open doors, and after about a month, I'd say, we're here, and then after 2 months, I'd say, why don't you ever open doors for me? See, because what happens is that part of our illusion is we create a fantasy or a role. And part of that fantasy and role is that we're trying to make something happen. We have those dreams about falling in love, but like people have said, nobody's ever really told us. So what happens is what we don't know and what we don't have knowledge of, we make up. We make it up. We have no other recourse. When you don't have concrete, healthy information, what you do is your unconscious simply fills in the void. So we create what we think it should be. But what happens is, and romance is the first stage of any relationship. First stage of a relationship is romance. Generally lasts 6 months to 18 months. But then what begins to happen is that we begin to move into another stage. And this is a stage where we kind of become disillusioned. Because a lot of what's happening at this point is now we're beginning to really find out the core of another person's being. And one of the things that we find out and psychology points out to us today is that how many of you here have ever said to yourself, I promise I will never say or do the things that my parents said or did to me. How many of you have said that? How many of you found yourself saying that, but found yourself actually saying those words or doing the very same behavior? Or how many of you said, I will never relate to a person like my mom or like my dad. I want to find somebody just the opposite. And then found that the person you picked has almost all the same kind of characteristics. Okay. See, because what psychology tells us is that without intervention and without education and a transformation, as we repeat 85 to 90% of generational behaviors. In other words, most of the learning and most of the way that we pick partners, most of the way we do it is unconscious. It's we relate to people because of familiar habits and familiar patterns. Okay? Now, in the romantic stage, we maybe talk about not wanting to do that, and of course, each of us is going to tell the other one that we would never do whatever it is, because we figured out that the other one doesn't want us to be like that. So we tell each other we would never do it, but what happens is after you live together for a while, you can't keep up that energy anymore. And so what we find in our culture, for example, in alcoholic homes and families, that if you come from an alcoholic home and family, your chances are 10 times that of another person who doesn't come from that kind of family of picking an alcoholic to be in a relationship. If both parents are alcoholic, your chances are even higher than that. If you come from an abusive home, you know, you have learned how to adapt around an abusive home. You've learned to take on a role to survive that kind of home. And so what happens, the people you are most attracted to are the people who you can adapt to and survive around. And so you end up in abusive relationships. See, and the degree of generational tradition suggests to us is that we are repeating patterns, we are repeating life scripts. And part of the reason for that is that because we're in this fantasy and illusion, we've really detached from our reality. See, our education system does nothing to us, nothing for us, because the education system is basically the three R's. So it's teaching us lots of intellectual functioning, which is vital and important, but it's not teaching us how to be a human being. It's not teaching us love, and it's not teaching us relationship. Okay. So what happens is that we get scared. If we turn to the church, what often happens in this disillusionment is the church has no solutions. The church, after making this commitment to marriage, where the church never even dealt with the concept of divorce. Never dealt with the concept of divorce because they just assumed, well, if we make a law and a value, those that make it are okay and those that don't make it, you're out. It used to be believed in the Catholic tradition that if you got a divorce, you were excommunicated. You know how you found out you were excommunicated? There's this early study done in the 70s. Amongst people who believed they were excommunicated from the church, how they found out was from a neighbor. The vast majority of them found out from a neighbor. Somebody told them, well, you're divorced, that means you're out of the church. See, in other words, the church made these kind of decrees about fidelity and relationship and then made this strong stand that, well, if you can't handle it, you know, you're obviously not a good Catholic or not a good Christian. And what happened was, but the church never put together any kind of process or procedure. And it wasn't until 1894 when one of the upper class families got divorced that the church even began to address the issue. And it was in 1894 that the American bishops got together and made a proclamation about divorce. And they reinstituted the excommunication law. But again, they developed no procedure about doing that. See, See, and this is one of the things to understand about the American culture. In the European culture, where most of our tradition comes from, for example, take the Italians, please. No. Not Henny Youngman.
Yeah.
I'm Italian, so I can say that. But in the Italian culture, they have all of these laws. You know, I mean, Rome, that's where the church is, and, you know, and that's where the legalistic Romans got together with the emerging Christians, and they put together a Roman church and made, you know, 1,400 and some odd canons and thousands of laws. But what happens in Italy is that you have the church and the law, and you're supposed to live up to that. But then what the Italians say is, well, if you can't handle this, then go ahead and go and fool around. See, so what Italians were saying is marriage is a sacrament, so you do not get a divorce. But if you're unhappy with your wife, you know, go find somebody else to fool around with. Italians and a lot of the Europeans are not as legalistic or pragmatistic. But in the American church, when the American church took on, you know, came over in the Puritan ethic that evolved, that, you know, that came a big part of the American church became highly pragmatic. So when the American church took on laws, it meant you lived to the letter of the law. And if you didn't live to the letter of the law, you were called a sinner or a failure or inadequate. And so what happened is, when you couldn't live up to this, there was no support in the church. There was only guilt and shame. So the third stage. Now what I want you to hear in this process is these stages of relationship are normal, healthy, and natural for any kind of relationship to manage and maintain itself. It's important that it goes through this process, gets into its disillusionment and despair, because you need to break the illusion. For it to be a healthy, real relationship, you need to face reality. But there was and has been, until recently, there has been no process for people to deal with disillusionment and despair. The church has been very black and white, meaning that if you make the commitment, you know, you remember all those old statements, well, if you made your bed, you got to live in it. Till death do us part. See, there was no room, there was no compassion. They left out the whole, you know, the whole incarnational presence of Christ. They could not look at the humanity of Christ and his forgiveness and his compassion and the love and the generosity that he reached out to those who were broken, to those who were disillusioned, to those who despaired. And he loved and healed and forgave. But the church couldn't see that, and we as a culture couldn't see that. So what literally happens is, as we go through a natural progression, and we go through a natural progression, but we are left. We are left in our grief, we are left in our shame, we are left in our guilt, we are left in our inadequacy. So what happens is this, and the phenomenon in this culture is we still highly value marriage or a monogamous relationship. So what we have is the phenomenon called serial monogamy. Meaning that if I can't make it in one relationship, what I do is try to get out of and get away from that relationship as fast as possible and kind of get back into the dating game and get back into, you know, the stream and see if I can find somebody else. Okay. Divorce rate hovers back and forth fairly close to 50% in their culture. But those who get married a second time, 67% of them get divorced. And the statistics get higher and higher as you go into repetitive relationships. See, the issue is not going out and finding somebody to be in love with. The issue is understanding that we need a healing, and we need a transformation, and we need a sense of hope. Many relationships die here. The resurrection cycle that Christ tried to teach us is that when you experience your death, there is a resurrection. There is hope, but that hope requires a transformation. It requires a new way of thinking. It requires a new way of looking. The best way that I can describe what happens to divorced, separated, widowed, unwed parents, couples who live together, gay relationships, is that we are all good people seeking a very important, healthy, significant human value. We desire to be together as community. We need to belong. We want to be loved, we want to be nurtured, we want to be stroked, but we are the blind leading the blind. So what we do is we practice unhealthy, unsafe rituals. We practice unhealthy and unsafe sex. We don't know how to distinguish. You know, we in our culture, the dating game, I think, is one of the biggest disasters. We don't teach children how to be intimate and friends, because the sense of intimacy and closeness and friendship is what we need most in our life. Loneliness is a pervasive disease in our culture, and millions upon millions of people die of loneliness. See, but the preoccupation of our culture is not loneliness or community. The preoccupation of our culture is sexual conquest. The illusion is being attractive, being seductive, having somebody to be with, power over that person. We sexualize. We have a $7 billion pornography industry. It's because of the obsession in our culture to sexualize. We teach children at an early age the dating game, which has to do with sexual roles, manipulation, and seduction. It doesn't have to do with intimacy, closeness, community, and friendship. We don't teach them the values that keep them bonded and close together. Instead, we teach them a dangerous game, which ultimately, and that's where romantic love comes from. Romantic love is a sexualized craving for intimacy and community and belonging. Marriage is not for everybody. Community is for everybody, because that's what everybody needs. Nobody has ever died in our culture from a lack of sex. Some people will try to tell you that. But I want you to know that thousands upon thousands of people die daily because of loneliness, because they don't know how to belong and they don't know how to be connected. Now, this is a real important transformation, because the resurrection process in this is to stand up and to acknowledge that the institutional perspective of marriage and love and community and sexuality is archaic and it's self-destructive and it needs to be transformed. That's our hope, because that's what we can do together. You can use the pain and the suffering and the realization when you can allow yourself to become aware and to challenge those beliefs, because your experience has already challenged those beliefs. That's what this is, disillusionment and despair. It's your spirit saying this doesn't work. And what we need to do is transform. The resurrection process is transform it into a new way of living, and into a new way of loving, into a new way of becoming whole, so that we see marriage as a sacred value, but put it in a different context. And to see that many of the needs that we have inside, that we have given to this concept of marriage, are needs that can be met in community, can be met in friendship. You know, that's a part of why this is so vital, because we have something in common to share together. Now I'm going to switch directions for a minute here, so I'm going to ask first, does this make sense to you? Anybody have questions as we're going? Thoughts, challenges?
Yeah,
go ahead and put it out here. Okay, the direction I want to switch to now is to talk about children. A little more than 100 years ago, when children were birthed into a family, there were certain absolute needs that were required of children. One is that part of what the culture had handed down was a very, very clear and clinical role stereotyping. Most of that was based on because we are not into our technological development at the time, and so it was mostly survival focus, that human beings and culture and community were simply trying to eke out a survival in the wilderness. Therefore, survival of the community, culture, family required that most of the family roles be roles of survival, of somehow each doing their part to meet the needs of the family. You know, so you have the mother, you know, who is the, you know, the primary parent. Who takes household chores. You know, so the mother is the primary influencer, nurturer in, you know, say 150 years ago. Father is provider, protector, decision maker. Again, in a male-dominated culture, males were to go out there and do the hard work of, you know, kind of pushing back the frontier, fighting the fights, building that, making, you know, getting the crops up. You know, somehow that it was the male responsibility to do that. So when children were birthed into this family, based on the child's gender, because there was in those times, because survival was primary, there was not the freedom to look at role identity as there is in our culture today. There was not the freedom to look at it because it was survival and nobody wanted to challenge it because they were basically trying to eke out a living and stay alive. So children being birthed by gender had very clear roles that they had to follow through. And they had very clear rituals of what they had to do, rites of passage. You know, so you see the young boy who tails around and basically has no responsibility until he can start doing chores. And of course his chores were outside chores. You know, and you couldn't wait till he got old enough that he could pick up a gun and go out hunting and shoot his first critter. You know, and that became a major rite of passage, you know, and then the sexual rites of passage of somehow getting him a female and becoming a man had to do with that whole standard macho. You know, if you can fight, if you can shoot a gun, you know, and if you can go out and have sex, you know, then you've made it in a lot of the traditional view. A woman's role was to develop the skill to be a good servant, to learn the craft of motherhood and being a spouse and a wife, and then was taught by the mother how to find a man to be the protector. You know, because a woman was not trained at that time, did not have the choice and the option. Okay, but now what happens is, in our cultures, we have the Industrial Revolution. And a part of what happens in the Industrial Revolution is that we start having, there are two major things that happen. One is that we start having gadgets and things to do a lot of the work, so working's a lot easier, so there's more time available. But the other thing, the other major part of what happened is World War I and II, because what happens now is, rather than with the Industrial Revolution, You don't find people going out there to eke out their living, to know how to do everything. They make their own clothes, they farm their land. Instead, what happens is things start getting put into factories, and people are now making money rather than developing that. So now they're factory workers. And when World War I starts, lo and behold, men have to go off to war, so the women go to the factories, and now women are making a living. Women are becoming a part of the workforce. See, what I want you to hear is that what had been a rigid role stereotype for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years was now being transformed and changed. And with the transformation and change, what happens to the children? Rigidly in our culture, you know, our children have been taught the traditional and same values, but what the children are experiencing is that, you know, while the children are trying to be taught the same values, because the school systems and the teaching of parents tends to be highly conservative and traditional, but what the children are seeing is that mom and dad are fighting a whole lot. Mom and dad don't necessarily do those things, and the man's image is decreasing a whole lot, and the woman is gaining more power, and the child is learning these things in school but saying, yeah, but God, you ought to see the mess that's really going on out here. So the child goes into a value of confusion. What happens to a child when they're in value of confusion? They rebel. They rebel. Another big issue that happened after World War I was the Great Depression. A lot of the values that have existed for the last few decades have come out of people, parents, who remember the Great Depression, who made a commitment in the generations before most of us that my children will never have to fear for something to eat, something to wear on their back. You know, so we had that great boom and burst of the 50s where prosperity, and after World War II, and it was prosperity, and Ike was in there, and before that it was FDR and a chicken in every pot, and, you know, in a gung-ho kind of, was that FDR or Truman? It was one of those guys. I can't remember which one. One of them had a chicken in every pot. But basically the value was is that out of a traditional historical perspective, people were saying, we would never want future generations to have to want and starve the way that we need to starve today. So we provided everything for our children. What those people did not recognize is that the pain and the horror that they went through in the Depression was a value and important. Because what's happened in succeeding generations is that you had kids who had all kinds of stuff, but none of them valued the stuff. The number one problem we have in schools today is boredom. What boredom means is that I don't feel attached. You value this and you tell me this is important because of all the suffering you did. Well, I have never suffered. So school sucks. I want a VCR for Christmas. I don't care if you want me to do chores to learn to be responsible. I want to go skiing. I'd rather sit at home and watch the soaps. You know, take me to a sports game. Let's go to the Nordstrom's half yearly sale. You know, we become a society that's compulsed with things. And so we have a generation like what they call the what's the baby boomer generation? It's a generation that's obsessed with things. You know, stereos, cars, dishwashers, TVs, VCRs. They were really into electronic gadgetry. And a lot of that is because we are detached. Now, what happens to a person when they feel bored and detached is eventually they become resentful. meaning that they start to feel angry. I have a society that's teaching us one thing, I see that they're doing a whole bunch of other things. I watch it on the tube all the time. I don't know that they're doing it, but I guess TV tells me that they're doing it. Okay. And eventually what happens is, if they don't know how to deal with their resentfulness in a healthy way, then this resentfulness turns into depression. And that's where we are as a culture. We are depressed. Because we have no spirituality. What we have, the way that we try to fill this depression, is addictions and compulsions. So we become preoccupied and obsessed and busy. And we put all of our energy into sex, or we put it into money, or we put it into things, or we put it into, I want more and more, faster and faster. But we're depressed. So now what you're seeing is, you've got parents, generations of parents who are in their own changing roles, and you've got generations of kids who are becoming depressed, who are bored, because the structure of society. Now what happens when this parent whose roles are changing tries to deal with parent this kid? What are the rules? What do you think the rules are for a parent to parent that kid? Yeah, but what are the rules of society? What's the responsibility of the parent? What does the culture tell us?
To be a super person.
Yeah, you have to be a super person. Haven't you ever heard, can't you control your kid? Your kid should know better than that. Or they call you up and say, you know, your child is having a real hard time here at school. They're not studying, they're getting lousy grades, and they're acting out. We'd like to know what you're going to do about that. And you're sitting there saying, you know, how do you parent an angry child? How do you parent a depressed child? Well, it used to be and hopefully what I want you to hear as I'm going on with this is that I'm going to give you most of the depressing news tonight, and we'll build from here on out. So hang in there if a lot of this sounds really depressing. I needed to say that because I was getting depressed talking about this stuff. See, what the rule traditionally has been in our culture, and it comes from the rigid Puritan ethic, you know, the Protestant work ethic of you are what you do, is that parenting was considered by and large authoritarian. Okay. So authoritarian meant that the parent had control over the child. So when daddy raises his voice, the kids hop too. Traditional values suggest spare the rod and spoil the child. So if the child got a little bit out of line and raising the voice wasn't enough, you slapped them, or you switched them, or you spanked them, or you beat them. You did whatever was necessary, and culturally, you were supported for doing that. Okay? But nowadays, since 1970, what we are recognizing is that this kind of authoritarian parenting is now termed domestic violence. You can't beat your kid. It's unhealthy to beat your child. A lot of the traditional values of our child were indeed highly abusive, sexually, physically, emotionally. Okay. So then you get a Benjamin Spock that comes along and says, let your child be. Go with the flow. Let them figure it out. So parenting went from the absolute authoritarian control to a passive parenting. Basically, the response was try to survive your parent, to parents was survive your child's adolescence and they'll love you for it when they grow up. And that didn't work because kids got absolutely out of control. There was nothing left to do. So where are we left today? Well, if this isn't more difficult, is all of this kind of stuff was based on the concept of nuclear family. Nuclear family is mom and dad and the kids. And that was considered the primary unit in our culture, the integrity of the nuclear family. That's only about a 50-year-old concept. Our tradition from European culture is the extended family, that when we lived together in communities, everybody had a part in the child rearing, so the whole extended family had a major influence. But because of industrialization, what's happened is people moved far apart, and so they had to survive on nuclear families because we couldn't travel the distances to stay together as extended families. And that's where nuclear family come from. But today, what we have is a combination of married, single parent, and because of divorce and remarriage, we have blended families. So now what you have is not only trying to figure out what's the proper parenting technique, but you got a whole bunch of people involved in it. There are estimated 11 million single-parent families in the United States, 70% of which the custodial parent is female. Blended families, the estimates are there are approximately about 13 to 15 million. So this is married, divorced, and mixed and matched. So what you're dealing with here is three or more parents. So what we've added into this whole concept now is, yeah, these are all nice, wonderful values, and sure, kids need all of these things for them to grow up happy, healthy, but how do I be a single parent when there's an absentee parent? And how do I be all things to my child? See, it's not possible. And how the hell am I supposed to give my kids some kind of consistent view of life when there are four people that they call mom or dad? Or that there may be a whole series of stepmoms and dads, and the kid's got three or four people he calls mom and three or four people they call dad. And so who's the primary custodial parent, and how do we work on, because obviously we had conflict in values and some kind of chaos in our lives and we disagree a lot, so what does a child do and how do we effectively parent in the midst of all of that chaos? Or if I have an absentee parent who I may be divorced, separated, widowed from, or never married in the first place, but this person demands some right of being involved in that child's upbringing, how do I do my primary parenting when there is this intrusive person that, one, I don't want to live with, but I have a lifelong, at least an 18-year relationship with? And how do I handle and manage myself? And what I want you to hear with all of this is the crisis of our culture. The church has been inadequate to respond to this because the church has been predominantly family-oriented. And so what happened is that when you were a kid, you maybe grew up in a church, and if you got married, you could sacramentalize your marriage in the church, and you could become a part of the church as long as you were family. But if you were single or you were divorced, there was no place for you. you felt kind of left out. You couldn't go to a lot of normal parish functions because you kind of felt like a fifth wheel. And a lot of the things that were being said and done planning-wise were not appropriate. Well, that's been changing. That's been changing a lot over the last 10 or 15 years. There are lots and lots of support groups out here, and we'll talk a lot about that on Monday in the closing session, or if others have other questions. So there is a change afoot, but I want you to hear, see, that change did not come from the institution church. That change came from people like you and me who stood up and said, you know, you can't write me off. I refuse to accept guilt and shame for your inadequate system. I want to learn. I want to love. I am not a bad person. I'm a healthy person striving to learn how to become human, how to love my child, how to be responsible, and how to stay sane in the midst of all of this process. And that's what this is about. Before, when I had that romanticism, disillusionment, and despair, well, that's the breaking down of the old system. The old system and a lot of the old beliefs are archaic. The values can remain intact, but we need a new way of loving and a new way of parenting, a new way of being supported. Going out and looking for another Mr. or Miss Wright is not going to solve your problem. It's going to mean a transformation from the inside out. It means being whole. The greatest gift that you could give your child as a parent is a solid, healthy, serene you. When you become powerful, when you become clear, when you know how to process your feelings and value your being, your blessedness, see, then you create a hope for your child that never existed before in the past. And that's one of the biggest things that I want to give to you during this retreat this weekend. That this is, we will talk about parenting skills. Okay, so we will address those issues. But what I want you to hear is that you can learn all of the techniques in the world, but if you are not transformed in here, none of those techniques mean anything. Because what would happen is you'd walk away from here maybe motivated and maybe saying, yeah. But again, what psychology tells us, within a week, you'll forget 90% of what you heard here. So what I want you to go away with is a burning you inside. A burning motivation that there is some hope and a commitment and a willingness to seek. Because this is one event. You know, think about it. The 20 billion year history of the universe evolved to the point so that we could all be here tonight. The universe has worked hard. God has worked hard for us to come here. And now the responsibility that is placed in our hands is for you and I to transform this archaic, failing system. For you and I to transform the ignorance of humanity. So the healing and forgiveness is not something that's going to happen to go out there and change the church or go home and tell my kid to do it differently. What's going to happen is for us to respect and to transform our belief about ourselves, our spirit in ourselves, our awareness and our hopefulness, so that we have a new kind of spirit and hope and love and clarity to bring to our children. Techniques don't make good parents. Because ultimately what happens is the motivation of the parent is what the child learns first. And I've been teaching kids, especially adolescents, for 17 years. And the one thing the kids say to me over and over and over and over again is that adults are hypocrites. And what I ask them what they mean, and what they say to me is, you keep telling us what to do, but you can't live it yourself. So we think it's all bull. What I find is, when I am able to be integrated and clear, because that's what a child does first, a child doesn't listen to your degrees or to your preaching. What a child says, are you living what you're saying? Do you believe in what you're doing? Because are you modeling it? Are you manifesting it for me? And when a child knows that you're trustworthy because they see you living the experience, then they're willing to pour their heart out to you. See, because then they're willing to take the risk and trust you. So it comes from the transformation in here first. That's the key. That's what we're working for. We transform this archaic system by transforming us. And what we then become is the light and the creation. You know, in essence, the universe and God has given us a responsibility. And now we can listen to our pain and transform our despair into an ability to respond, into a hopefulness, into a new way of living and a new way of loving. So that's what this process is about. You know, and again, we will address techniques and we will talk about children and get to know your needs. But I still want to emphasize that the primary focus is you. You are the one who had the courage to come here. You are the one with the desire and the willingness. So this moment was made for you, this weekend was made for you, and we were meant to be together. From wherever we came, we were meant to be here. There is definitely something afoot in the universe. And I'm glad to be here and be a part of you tonight. We've got a few minutes, ended a little bit early for this first session. Yep. You know, is what I'm saying making sense to you? Are there questions, thoughts, feelings, things that you haven't heard that you want to hear? Questions you have about what's ahead? Give me some feedback.
But
go ahead.
The inner questions that I came with that I didn't quite put words to know, I came wanting to know how to have intimacy and community without sexuality, without sexual desire being in the middle of that. As you know, as you talked about earlier, we've been programmed to think that that is primary. And my sense inside is telling me what I heard you say tonight, that intimacy and community are very necessary to our survival, the sense of being loved, of being loving, acceptable for ourselves, acceptable to others, without sexual things being
right.
Seeking.
Good. And a word that I would say to that, what we understand now today, and Sid Simon, who was big in the 60s and 70s with the values clarification materials, you remember those things? He did another book that really impressed me, and that book was done about 15 years ago, and it was called Caring, Touching, and Feeling. And one of the phenomena that he talked about in that book was a phenomenon called skin hunger. And what he was saying in that is that in our birthing process, you know, our body is our primary sense organ. Our body is primary, one, because it's first in reality. It's the first part of us that is bombarded with this reality that we live in. It's primary because of that, you know, that being in the world. And what he's saying was is that skin hunger is one of our basic needs. And the researchers, for example, during the Nazi years and Nazi occupations, when they would take children to orphanages, they would put them into cribs, but they would never touch them. And what they found is the vast majority of children that were not touched either degenerated. They were fed. They went in and fed them on regular clockwork time, and they were changed, but they were never picked up, nurtured, and stroked. Okay, and that the children who did that, vast majorities of them died. And the only thing that they could isolate, because the Germans were offering good care in terms of other basic needs, but they would not pick up the children and hold them. And many of the children decayed and withered and died. There's now, in the reparenting field of psychology, a focus that says that that the basic boundaries or our basic self-esteem has to do with the way that we were parented in our conception through the birthing process and how we were treated in our early childhood, because psychology tells us that our basic personality and belief about ourselves is already established by age 3. Meaning that we learned everything about ourselves that we believed about ourselves before we could talk or think. We learned it in our body. It was a relationship. It was a physical relationship. And what the psychology says to us, the reparenting psychology says to us, is that a child gets its value in two ways. The first is being fed. If a child is fed on a consistent basis, when it needs to be fed, it is heard, it is attended to in a nurturing, encouraging, affirming way, then that child will have an internal sense of worth and value. The second part of esteem has to do with being stroked. So being fed has a lot to do with my internal sense of self, and being stroked has a lot to do with my external sense of self. In other words, the child learns its boundaries with other people, learns about healthy relationship and being held in the bond that happens between the mother and the child's eyes while the child is feeding at the breast, and being changed on a consistent and regular basis, so that a lot of our basic intrinsic need as human beings, because we are body persons, is that we need to be stroked and touched. See, but we've grown up in a culture that wants to deny touch. We grow up in a culture of fear because we weren't taught about sexuality. We were told to ignore our bodies. We run around and hide from each other. Nurturing and affirming was considered a feminine characteristic, so in a male-dominated culture, we avoided it like the plague. See, and so what's happening in our culture today is we have a lot of obsessions, a lot of the addictions. And this psychology suggests that this is what a lot of addiction is. Chemical addictions, eating disorders, compulsive needs to put things in to get a basic need met that we never got met in our early childhood. That a lot of the sexual acting out that goes on in our culture today is a need to be nurtured and stroked. It's a need to be nurtured, not a need to be screwed. See, we have a need to somehow belong and value. But we haven't learned the healthy techniques of knowing that being a friend and getting a hug doesn't have to mean I have to go to bed with you. Or that sometimes I just need to have my shoulders rubbed, or I need somebody to just be with me or to be close to me. Or I need to do nurturing things for our body. We're told to do seductive things to our body, but not told to nurture ourselves. So we tend to be real out of control and addictive and compulsive in our culture. So I think your issue is right on, because I think that's a lot of what we all face as human beings, that we talk about the community, the Christian community, of wanting to be of one God. And we have lots and lots of intellectual awareness that tries to give us the intellectual understanding, but the problem is that people don't know how to be together, because when they come up against each other, they're afraid. Because we don't know how to do this in healthy ways. That's part of what's wonderful about the celebration, whether it's eating together as community or eating together as family, when it can be done in a healthy environment. Take that over and against stopping at a 7-Eleven or going to McDonald's, or garbage fooding yourself to death. That quick food is a part of our compulsive eating. In this culture, what the culture is basically saying is, we know you've got the addiction, we know you've got the need inside, so what we're going to do is make 24-hour food chains to make it available to you all the time, because we know you don't know how to take care of this by yourself. So when we learn these healthy values for ourselves, and then we internalize it and believe it and we're willing to live it, then we have something to teach our children. See, for you to learn the technique and say, well, what you need to do is stop eating red meat, you need to eat, low cholesterol, low fat. You can tell them all of that crap, but if you're running over to McDonald's all the time on your lunch break because you're too busy, see, then the kids are basically going to say to you, yeah.
It was like she was speaking through me. I was going to ask the same question. I think it's important enough to, hopefully at some time during the course of the weekend that we might address that. I don't know how, but in small groups or role play, actually confronting that kind of issue because it is so prevalent. I find myself, as I change and grow and mature into the person that I'm meant to be, that's a projection of love and compassion, but I find that women from the other side are using that as a method to get to me sexually. And it's very frustrating to be able to try and relate to a woman on a one-on-one basis and to deal with the same issue that she just talked about.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. See, that's why this is so prophetic. You may say, well, I'm at a weekend retreat in Holden Village, but I want you to think of the 5 billion people in the world. There aren't that many people to gather in places like this to do things like this. This is a very special, a very privileged reality that you have a chance to be here. We will address those questions. And we will learn some of the technique about how to do this thing. And we still have 5 minutes before the popcorn and ice cream is. I was told by the staff up here that if I wasn't out of here by snack bar time, they'd all walk out on me anyway. So, so anybody, other thoughts or questions? Okay, tomorrow what we're going to start in, and we'll do the 2 sessions tomorrow around grief. And part of the importance of grief is that grief is the tool that gets us back to our bodiliness, and grief is the way that our body has tried to teach us the archaicness of the old structures and the old systems. So grief is a way that we learn to come alive when we are not afraid to feel our grief. And that's a part of what we're going to deal with, and this is also going to touch into parenting, because I'm also going to talk about how children in their normal development learn grief, but how we as culture and parents have denied them the right to their grief because we are terrified and don't know how to do our grief. And so we're going to hopefully create the possibility of, rather than reacting out of fear and terror, learning how to acknowledge in love and support. So thank you for tonight. I'm looking forward to being with you for the rest of the weekend. I want to say to you that, I'm giving you a lot of information tonight, and I'll give you some cursory information tomorrow, but from tomorrow on out, we're going to be doing more of talking with one another and grouping together, so you'll have a chance to share your experience, because my belief is that, as in the human being, I may be offering you a structure which is kind of like a skeleton, but it's your experience and your history and your feelings and your reality which becomes the lifeblood of this. So your experience is as valuable as anything that I offer.